The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, I certainly wish you all a Happy New Year. And as a talk for this first Monday of the New Year, I would like to give a talk on faith. Faith is considered in our tradition to be sometimes seen as a seed that you plant and seed that you water, and that so much can grow from that seed. You have trouble hearing out there? So I don't know if there's some way, Victor, to turn up on the outside?
It's cranked up.
It's cranked up all the way out there. So I don't know if the button on the outside can be the knob. That's on the outside. What?
Check to see if the knob on by the pillows.
Jim will do it. Is it all the way up? So there's not much we can do out there. You can kind of come closer, bring your chairs closer, or I can speak louder, or I don't know what to do. There's a few seats in here. A couple of chairs in here. There's a chairs up, one chair right here, in the front. Right here. So faith is sometimes compared to a seed, and it's a sort of seed that you can plant, nourish and grow, and beautiful things can grow out of the seed. It also said in Buddhism that faith, it attracts a lot of wholesome qualities. Some of the healthy, beautiful qualities of heart and mind that a person can have are attracted to faith, and they get expressed in people's lives then. Faith has a really beautiful quality of mind, of heart, of being. And it's also one that bothers some people. Some people come to Buddhism, here in the West at least, almost intentionally to avoid faith because they've somehow been troubled by the way the word faith is used in perhaps in some of the Western religions, where it's meant maybe you have to believe something blindly, a creed or a faith that doesn't seem to be quite fit in rational thought or rational belief. And it seems like too much to have to have faith when it seems impossible to believe these things. In thinking about it today, I was reminded of something I was told a long time ago about olive growers in Greece. Now, apparently, it takes an olive tree a long time to bear olive fruit that you can harvest and make olive oil or something. And I was told that there's olive farmers in Greece, sometimes in their old age, you know, they're maybe 60, 70 years old, will plant. I don't know how olive trees are planted, you know, whether it's a seed or whether it's a cutting or something, but will plant a new olive tree, knowing that that olive tree will not bear fruit in that farmer's lifetime. And olive trees live for a long time. And so it's, why would you do something that's not for yourself? You know, why would you do something that's, in a way, in the future? You know, you can spend your time doing other things. But I associate this kind of beautiful quality, you know, it's kind of a certain kind of faith. A movement which is beyond your personal concerns, but connecting to your life, to the life of other people, to people of the next generations, your life to something larger here. And I think it's quite beautiful. What is it? What movement of heart, what movement of inspiration would cause someone to be concerned for the future in that way and to plant something that will bear fruit in the future? faith in that it's a seed also has this aspect of there's something that, you know, we have some inspiration, some confidence that something will bear fruit in the future, something good will happen in the future, something or something right will happen, something will ripen for us. And and sometimes faith has more to do about the possibility in the future than it has to do with this moment right here. Or it might be you have faith that if you engage this moment in the right way, something will follow, something will develop and grow. And in my faith, you know, as I've encountered Buddhism, I've developed a lot of faith in the practice, in the teachings, and it takes many different forms and shapes. But like one of them that it still actually moves me, inspires me, is that I have faith in the practice of mindfulness, and that if I engage in the practice, I might not see in the first minute, the first hour, the first day, like on a retreat or something, any benefit. But I have faith that if I just keep doing it and just apply myself, that somehow it bears fruit, something beautiful will flower with it. And I've seen over and over and over again how the engagement in it, when in the moment there didn't seem to be any beautiful fruit, but just keep doing the continuity of it, something moves and shifts and changes. It's quite remarkable. That I can't take credit for. I mean, I can, you know, to me to say, well, it's because I did all this mindfulness practice, and was meditated and practiced, therefore I'm responsible. I have to do my part, but I can't, it doesn't feel like I'm the one who's, you know, made this change. And so it feels in some ways non-personal or transpersonal or something that I have faith in or trust in or confidence in can kind of sort of operating and move through me or move with me or move within me that is not the same thing as my conscious choice or my conscious, you know, organizing of things or making things happen. And so I like the word faith because it inspires me to a great degree. It's something that warms me up quite a bit, something that gladdens me, brings me joy and delight and a certain kind of love to know that there's this dharma, this practice, this unfolding of the heart or the mind that can happen that I'm not exactly responsible for except for showing up, except for doing the practice moment by moment. Some people, the word in Pali, in the Buddhist language, is sadha, and it's translated most often into English as faith, but it doesn't have to be translated as faith, so if you don't like the word, I'll offer you some others. Another word is confidence, which is a nice word, and confidence you know, doesn't lend itself to some of the pitfalls, religious pitfalls that maybe faith has. So we have confidence in all kinds of things, but to have confidence in practicing a spiritual discipline, confidence in practicing mindfulness or meditation or loving kindness, confidence in the goodness of our heart, confidence in the possibility of transformation and change, confidence in the teachings of Buddhism, are all that confidence can be small and just enough so maybe, you know, you go to the bookstore and buy another book. Or it can be really powerful, so powerful that you change your life, you know, 360 degrees or a complete turnaround of your life where what you do with your life and becomes completely different from what it was without that confidence. You have so much confidence in becoming free, so much confidence in practicing, so much confidence in different values and how you have been living, that you decide to give up your job or, you know, all kinds of things. You might just, you know, go on a long retreat, many things you can do. Some people go off to, in Buddhism, and become, you know, full-time practitioners and engage in deep, deep inner work. So confidence, you know, is this motivator for people. If you don't have confidence, why would you do anything? William James, who was an American psychologist, philosopher, wrote about the value of faith. And he said that if a person comes across a chasm, say that's maybe 6 foot big kind of canyon or something, and they're told to jump over that chasm. So I don't know if 6 feet is the right distance or something, but or let's say it's just a chasm first without a distance. So, or say it this way, say it's 2 feet, jump. So, you know, most people, I think, who can jump, have confidence they can jump the 2 feet. Not a big deal, no matter how far down it goes. You jump over the 2 feet, you can do that. But at some point, the distance, if you spread out the distance in the chasm, it gets so far that if you believe you can't do it, you won't be able to. But if you believe you can, you can. Belief makes a difference. However, the tricky thing is, at some point, the distance becomes so great that it doesn't matter how much faith you have. And if you have too much faith and you jump, you're in trouble. So you have to be careful with faith. There has to be some, you know, connection between what's possible, but what's possible, but there's a certain kind of little segment there. What's possible is only possible because you have faith. Isn't that interesting? It's kind of a catch-22. Well, you know, if you don't have faith, then how do you get faith? How do you believe it? So faith, you know, I think has a significant role in our life. And one of the functions in Buddhism is to bring a certain degree of confidence, but also a certain degree of delight or joy or inspiration or heartfeltness in the practice. Faith in Buddhism, sadha, is sometimes referred to as emotional. It's kind of connecting to our emotional aspect of our being. It's supposed to be balanced with wisdom, and wisdom is said to be more intellectual in a sense. If you're only into the wisdom part of Buddhism, then it gets too dry and intellectual. But if you're only into the faith part, then it gets too emotional and wet. And the idea is to have a combination of balance of both. But faith is what brings the warmth to it, or the wholeheartedness to it. And without being wholehearted, it's very difficult to, you know, make much leeway in this whole Buddhist enterprise. So to help perhaps understand faith in Buddhism, it's interesting and maybe useful to take the word English word faith and make it into an acronym. And so the F is freedom. And this is lays at the heart of what Buddhism is about. The whole purpose in which the Buddha designed his teachings or put them together was for the purpose to help people become free. Sometimes it has grand names in English, like enlightenment or awakening. But it's a little bit confusing to use those kinds of terms, because enlightenment and awakening, it's a little bit hard to understand what that is. And people have these grand ideas and imaginations of what enlightenment is and how you're going to float on a cloud or walk above the water, or, you know, or live happily ever after, or I don't know what. Or they believe it involves some the Big Bang theory of enlightenment. You know, you sit there quietly and boom! Lightning strikes, and then, you know, you're enlightened, and then you can be happy ever after. I think sometimes those kinds of words lend themselves to a lot of confusion and mysticism and stuff. But the word freedom, I feel, is much more practical. It's not so not as abstract. Freedom means to be free, and free from what, or free of what. And so here it's very interesting to see that Buddhism emphasizes freedom from, versus kind of a common American approach to freedom, which is freedom to. So America, you know, freedom to speech, freedom to assembly, freedom to religion, freedom to vote, freedom to, what are some other freedoms? Freedom to own property, freedom to shop. You know, there's all these freedoms too. And people in America, there's certainly a strand of American culture where the individual doesn't want to be limited. It doesn't want to be limited by government. There's a popular strand in some corners because they don't want to limit my freedom. I should be able to do on my property whatever I want. The government shouldn't tell me what to do. And so there's a kind of a very strong momentum in America to associate freedom with the freedom to. There's nothing wrong with that. I think it's quite appropriate in many circumstances. However, if you have the freedom to shop, because you have an unlimited credit card, then you might never look at what is driving you to shop. And there might be a lot of neurosis, or a lot of greed, or a lot of fear, or a lot of loneliness, or many different things that can drive drive a person's desire to have and acquire and get. And so the momentum, the push to get and have, can be strong. And the insistence is that I need to be freedom too, don't get in my way, then the person will never turn around and look at what's motivating them. And if the credit card is unlimited, there's no need to, because you can just kind of shop to abandon. Some people, when the credit card runs out of money, then they get to look. And they realize how addicted they are to some things. And then they can look more deeply, what is it that drives them to do these kind of behaviors? So there's many behaviors we do that if we're free to do them, which has a certain joy and delight to have the freedom of action doing, we don't actually see that we're not actually that free. We're free to do, but we're not free from our craving, our clinging. We're not free from all these strong impulses, sometimes very deep unconscious impulses, that gets us to act in ways that maybe later we even regret. So Buddhism puts emphasis on turning the focus inward so that we're not... And so this is where Buddhism can sometimes uses a very strong word, I believe. It says, so we're not slaves to these deep impulses of our own mind and heart that can be there. So we're not slaves of greed, not slaves of hate, or fear. So the idea in Buddhism is not to become free to do whatever you want, but to become free from these inner forces. This is very liberating because then you're not a slave, you're not contracted, you're not being forced to do things you regret, you're not being forced to do things that cause damage in the world. And more importantly, when you're not living under compulsions, we have inner compulsions that drive our behavior, then there's much more choice. And personal freedom, from our psychological freedom, spiritual freedom, comes when we have choice in what we do, how we act, what motivates us, the motivations we follow through on. And then we can be free of inhibition, for example, which can limit our freedom to do certain things. Some people are afraid to speak in public. So, it's not freedom to, would be, I don't know what it would take for some people. Maybe, tie everybody up first so that you're safe in speaking. Then you can talk to the abandoned. Free from your inhibition, then, you have more choice to act freely when you speak. So Buddhism, the whole focuses on freedom. And this is the possibility of becoming free is quite immense. And you get a sense of it when you understand how pervasive and deep compulsions are in our mind. And people who meditate can get a glimpse of this when they try to stop their thinking. or try to stay focused on their breath. And it's not uncommon for some meditators to realize that, or kind of joke a little bit, perhaps, or maybe it's not a joke, that they're addicted. I mean, that's the only way to explain this, you know, how the drive and compulsion to get involved in thinking. And, you know, I'm Gil, I'm a thinker, recovering thinker. Once a thinker, always a thinker. So we come to IMC for our meetings. So the idea of, you know, so to get a sense, you get a sense of, you know, the power of compulsion just through meditation. As the mind gets quieter and quieter and stiller, there's people can see and also have intuition to possibilities of being radically free, revolutionarily free from compulsion, from craving, from greed, from grasping. And those functions, those operations of grasping and greed and attachment and resistance and fear, they operate in very subtle and powerful ways that lay the foundation for parts of people's personality, character, beliefs, political affiliations, you know, behavior, relationships to other people. It's quite a powerful thing, what goes on. I had was meeting with someone recently who was grieving over the loss of a spouse. It was an unfortunate death of a spouse. And so what do you do when you're counseling someone who's grieving, still crying, and, you know, the loss seems quite fresh, maybe a year ago or so? So normally you would maybe listen to them, you would normally support them, make space for them, tell them it's okay, listen, you know, just a lot, you know, kind of grief counseling things. After getting to know her for some time, I pointed out in a very careful and I hope it was a loving way that her grief was impregnated, was coming out of her conceit. Now, isn't that a powerful thing to tell someone who's grieving loss of a spouse? You know, you're conceited. You know, you usually don't say that. But I can get away with that. You know, because, you know, that's kind of like the part of the Buddhist teacher license. You know, if you say it the right way, of course, and the right timing, and with a lot of respect and love and care. But you can say things like that, because even, and the reason I'm telling you this now is that even something like, you know, the dramatic grief of the loss of a spouse is not necessarily always just a pure, natural, you know, grief of loss. It itself can be entangled with compulsions, with clingings that we have. And sometimes those attachments and clinging have to do with self-identity issues that we have. And so the freedom of Buddhism is very, very profound issue or possibility that we all have. And so the faith, Buddhism is really a faith in the possibility of freedom. And this is something that human beings can do. It's a worthwhile goal. And it's a worthwhile goal to kind of somehow be oriented around in your life. The second, the A of faith, is authenticity. Honesty, being truthful. That part of the function of faith in Buddhism is to inspire us, to move us towards greater and greater authenticity. And so this has a lot to do with mindfulness practice. Mindfulness is a practice of being honest. And I think it's synonymous. You know, we sit down, in meditation, we sit down, maybe close our eyes, and we try to be really honest about what our experience is right here and now. Many times it's relatively mundane, you're honest, you're just being truthfully present for your breath, your in-breath and out-breath. But there can also be, it's very hard sometimes to have really honest with oneself. And so to slowly discover how to be authentic. And authentic doesn't mean that you have to be a saint. It means that you're completely honest about being a devil. It doesn't mean that you act on being a devil, but you don't kind of try to be pretty and pretend you're something you're not. But you try to do your best you can to live a good life by being authentic. So a little story from recently. I was eating with some friends, and it was time for me to go. So I stood up to leave, and one of the people there had some business to take care of with me. And I said, I'm feeling uncharacteristically impatient. Which was true. I was just saying how I was feeling. I wasn't saying I was leaving or anything, but I just wanted them to at least know that I wasn't feeling impatient in case they picked it up and felt that, that was somehow... I just wanted them to know. I was hoping to leave. They'd let me go. But as it was, I had to sit down and listen, take care of the business. Anyway, so that was the end of the story for me. But later, a few days later, someone who was at the table said how inspired they were that I had been so truthful. Because maybe normally you don't tell people I'm impatient, but so this idea of being authentic, and I did it in a way I wasn't being critical of anyone or. I didn't feel proud of being impatient. It just happened to be how I was. I didn't feel like embarrassed by being impatient. I was just impatient. So I was going to tell them, and then we all take that into account. Or I thought they would take it better into account. So anyway, to be authentic is part of faith. And I hope that that's not something you feel like you can argue against. But a very important part of this faith in Buddhism and the whole mindfulness enterprise is to be authentic and discover how to do that in a way that's helpful for you and helpful to others around you. And then the I is intention. That part of having faith is to have an intention. An intention is a very important part of being a human being. A lot follows in the wake of our intention. In fact, there's a saying in Buddhism that everything depends on the tip of our intention. That the growing point where intention is heading, that so much follows the result of that. When I was doing Zen practice in San Francisco Zen Center, I was told that one of the primary aspects of Zen practice was the purification of our intention. That if the intention was pure, everything else would take care of itself, would follow it in time, things would unfold. But the idea is there has to be some intention, there has to be some choice to choose something different than being neurotic. Otherwise, there's no hope, right? Or choose something different than business as usual. Because if you're suffering and you say, well, I'm just going to accept my life as it is, does that mean just accept all your suffering? No, Buddhism is about freedom from suffering. And so the naive acceptance that just allows you to continue suffering doesn't bring freedom. So there's a choice, an intention to change one's life and move in a different direction. It doesn't have to be a dramatic change at first, but there has to be some choice, some intention. And so that's part of the reason why there's unusually a lot of people here, the first Monday of the new year. I imagine that, it's well known. That a friend of mine used to run a gym, owned a gym. He said that, he really depended on all, so his whole business depended on all these people who signed up in January. So here we are, we're over spilling out to the outer room. We'll see, in 6 months. The beginning of the year, people set their intention. And so to set an intention, and then part of the function of faith is certainly to make a choice, but then to have fuel and energy behind that choice. So we stick to it, so we engage in it, so we keep going in it. But there has to be a choice. And so what's that choice that you make with faith, with confidence, with trust? So the choice to be free, perhaps, or a choice to try to be free, a choice to practice, a practice that leads to freedom. So so let me get a T, right? And for T, there's trust. So that's one of the synonyms for the word sadha, the Pali word for faith, is trust. And I love the word trust myself because it's been a very important part of my own Buddhist practice, is a deep trust in, well, someone asked me many, some number of times people have asked me, what do you trust in? And what do you have faith in? And for a long time I thought it was a strange question. The in part. I just had trust. You have to have trust in something? I didn't feel a need to fill in the in something. Just trust. What does that mean? To have trust. It means not exactly acceptance, because that can have its problems. But for me, it meant that the strongest thing I have faith in or trust in is that if I'm mindful, if I'm completely honest and mindful and present, then this moment here, as it unfolds, is trustable. And that's quite a powerful thing to have faith in, to have trust in. That if I'm mindful of this moment, if I'm mindful here and now, then I can trust the unfolding of things. Now, I'm sure you can think of reservations about that. If I stand there in the middle of Highway 101 and just really are mindfully present, is that enough? Everything will unfold beautifully as I get splattered on the pavement? Of course, we take care of ourselves and avoid traffic, standing in the way of trucks and stuff and that barreling down the freeway. But we can't avoid all the trucks heading our way, right? Sooner or later, some truck's going to get you, the metaphorical truck. And things happen in our life. But what we can protect ourselves from is we can protect ourselves from the way that our mind adds suffering to that event. How we get afraid. How we resist the inevitable. How we get angry. How we get lost in the fantasy and imagination of the future. How we create all these scenarios in our mind. How we, there's so many things that we do that in Buddhism the shorthand for is clinging. And when we cling, we create suffering for ourselves. When we're mindful, mindfulness is the protection from us clinging. So hopefully we'll know what to do, out in the street. But when I'm mindful, I'm protected. And I'm protected from myself. And I don't know how about how you are. But this is really good news for me. Sometimes I've been a little bit frightened by the image, the imagination of what I would have been like if I hadn't discovered Buddhist practice. I don't think it would have been a pretty picture. Anyway, so this is a level of trust, and trusting the practice, trusting oneself, trusting the teachings, trusting a process of unfolding and deepening and moving through us. And I think that trust part is very important because one of the neuroses people have is to take too much responsibility. One of the ways to take too much responsibility is the conceit that I'm not good enough. I can't do this. Or one of the, is there the conceit, look how great I am. I'm the one who's doing it. Who needs trust? I'll just barrel through this. But I think that to trust something that is not your willful efforts, not your egotistical efforts. I'm fond of, I think it was Max Faraday who came up with some of the laws of thermodynamics, was asked where he came up with his laws, how to discover his laws. And he said, something inside of me which is not myself. Isn't that beautiful? So I like that because, you know, I'm more comfortable with that than saying, you know, something external. But trust, what do we trust? So this idea of trust, I think, is beautiful. And then the last H. It's interesting, the word for H, because it ties back to, apparently, back, the word sada, shraddha in Sanskrit, goes back to ancient Indian Vedic literature, the Rig Vedas, you know, some of the oldest literature of India. And apparently, scholars say that the original meaning or the root of the word shraddha meant hospitality. And it had to do kind of with hospitality you had towards the gods. You know, so you would create this ritual space and you would invite the gods in and feed them. I don't know what they did. I'm not so sure what it was all involved, but hospitality. And I think that's beautiful. So the H of faith is to be hospitable. And to be hospitable means that you offer something. It's not only about you getting. It's not only about you trusting and allowing something to happen. It's not only about you setting an intention. Or not only you focusing on faith, you know, on freedom for yourself. But there's also something we offer when that we're living not just this life for ourselves, but we're being hospitable to our experience, for one, that we don't accept our experience so much, but we create a hospitable environment in our mind. We're not in conflict with our experience. And the idea of being a host, I think, is a nice one. Maybe I'm a host for my pain, for my suffering, as opposed to be to fight it. But then also the idea of hospitality, to me, in my mind, also implies the idea that we also live to be good hosts to the world around us. If the world is our home, we're the host as much as the guest. And so to be hospitable, to be someone who has offers hospitality to our fellow human beings, the fellow world, where we are willing to be someone, to live a life such a way that people can have faith in us, have confidence in us, have trust in us, that we're a trustable person, that we're a safe person, that we're someone that people can go to for help. So here, you know, at IMC, we come here, hopefully this environment here is hospitable enough that you feel like you can practice here. But you're coming here, you're also being a host. You're not only here, just the fact that you're here, you're creating and supporting other people to practice. And so part of faith is to open up your life, your heart, so that you're also living for the benefit of others. That's what the host part implies. So faith, freedom, authenticity, intention, trust, and hospitality. So I hope that as you embark on this year, 2011, that freedom and authenticity and intention and trust and hospitality is something that grows in you into a beautiful blossoming plant. Thank you.